Hey guys, my name is Crystal Kenny, and I'm in love with creating. All things artistic and imagination involved. I'm an American girl who chased her creative dreams all the way to Paris, France, making a living using photography. This podcast takes you inside the stories of all the artsy folks I've met along the way and gives you that extra push to discover your creative gifts. The desire to create is deeply inside each and every one of us, and I give you the tools and inspiration to find a new way of living a more creative life. This is La Vie Creative, the podcast. Claudine Hemingway is a descendant of famed writer Ernest Hemingway. We bumped into each other at a party and decided to team up and dive deep into French history, but with a twist, by bringing a spotlight to those lesser-known creatives in France. This is History with a Hemingway.
Hey guys, thanks so much for listening. If you want more bonus material and to support the show, head on over to patreon.com/lavie creative. And also don't forget to check out Amazon, where you can pick up my new book, Paris, A Life Less Ordinary. In the book, I talk about my creative adventures in Paris, from starting my business to being homeless, hello, starving artist, to how I met all these wonderful creative people. Don't forget to check it out on Amazon. And also thank you so much once more for listening and for your support. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to Paris History avec Hemingway. Today we are talking about Valtesse de la Vigne. I knew nothing about her, just like most of our ladies, because I was bringing all these fascinating women into my life. And she was another courtesan, which we are very, you know, we're in love with courtesans. Let's just face it. We love them, don't we, Claudine?
We do. Well, they had such a glamorous life.
They did. And, you know, like, it was hard to work your way up and, you know, the hierarchy of those times, and women weren't allowed to do anything. So power to them, you know, like they worked their way up. And Valtesse did not have an easy start. So even more power to her. Like most of our women, they had terrible parents.
Yeah, most of them did. I mean, it's hard work and perseverance that takes you from the bottom rung of prostitutes to the top.
I love it. It's like there is no glass ceiling for prostitution. We're just breaking
through. No, she is like, she's really fascinating. I actually came across her in a very strange way years ago in the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris, which is in technically the entire, you know, it's actually in the Louvre itself as far as like the structure is concerned. An amazing, amazing museum. If you haven't been, you have to go. But I went through and I go into this room and it has this great big bed with this huge canopy, which we'll talk about later. And I was like, oh my gosh, what is this? And so I read the placard they had on that and made some notes, and then came back and did some research on her and found this book that was written about her, which was amazing. And ever since then, I'm just like completely fascinated by her.
You're obsessed with her. And you said the bed was beautiful.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was, it had like a huge canopy in the back that's really, really high. And it had like, just lots and lots of, now it's green, but originally it was blue, velvet hanging down. It had at one point, these perfume burners on it.
Wow, that is cool. I want to get some perfume burners for my bed.
I know. It was really cool. Maybe it's because, you know, when I was a kid at one point, I remember for my birthday, I got a canopy bed and it was like the most exciting thing ever. And I still think about that canopy bed because it's so just such a princess.
Or a courtesan.
It did not look anything like hers, but, you know, the thought was there.
So what, like, I was reading about her. She had a terrible childhood. Her father was like an abusive alcoholic. Her mother was a prostitute. Some bad things happened to her. Like, how did she come so far?
Well, when she, like you said, when she was born, she was one of six kids. Her father was an alcoholic and not really there at all. Her mother was a laundress, which at the time, a lot of the laundresses and seamstresses also at the same time were prostitutes because they didn't make a lot of money. So they would kind of, you know, find other ways to make money. And she was just 10 years old. She started working at a candy store in the ninth on the Rue Notre Dame de Lorette, which the Lorette is a whole nother thing about Lorettes are also kind of were considered prostitutes. It's kind of worked around that area. A lot of them were seamstresses and laundress. But she was just 10 years old and she went started to work in a candy store, which is a 10-year-old. That's a pretty great place to work.
I was going to say that actually sounds like maybe kind of hellish because you just want to eat everything.
I know. It probably was pretty hard. But at 13, she started working in a dress shop as a seamstress. And she was 13 years old and they would have her work like 12 hours a day, which is just crazy. Clearly, there's no child labor laws in.
Nope.
But to make extra money, she started working the street as a lorette. And so that means you weren't a full-blown prostitute. You just kind of did it to make a little extra money.
It was a side job.
Yeah. And there was different ranks. So there's like the demi-monde in the demi-monde world, which was basically there's the prostitutes. The grisette was named after the gray fabric that they used to wear. Hmm. For these working class women, and lorettes were also from that same area. And then you go up a little higher, of course, you get to the courtesan, which is the highest. So she, you know, you had to work your way up. But as a child, she met the artist Camille Corot, and she would go and visit him at his studio. And she would just in the 10th and she'd just sit there and watch him paint. And he would paint these beautiful landscapes of the Ville d'Avry, which is just outside of Paris. And he would tell her all about it and tell her about this beautiful, quiet little town. And he would sing as he was painting. And she would just sit there and watch. There's nothing sordid about the story.
Nothing creepy there.
It was just a very innocent. She'd sit there and watch him. But that town comes into play a little bit later on. So, but when she started getting a little bit older and she, you know, was, you know, making more money. And so when you were the higher the rank you got, the better clothes you would be wearing. And, you know, the lower ranks, you know, they were, like we said, the grisette, they were wearing these kind of, you know, very unflattering, very, you know, gray, not very cute outfits. So it wasn't the Bois de Boulogne late night crowd.
Different. We were walking around there the other day. We ran into some lovely ladies in the Bois de Boulogne.
The oldest profession in the world.
Yes, it is.
But she's, you know, as she got a little bit older, she started attending the different balls around Paris and the parties. And she'd go to the Bal Musettes. And she had this weakness for men in uniform with mustaches. Like, that's just what did it to her. That just made her weak in the knees. She had a type. So she would go to these parties and she'd meet these men. She'd also go to one that was called the Salon de Mar, which was just off of the Champ de Mar near the Eiffel Tower. And she, you know, would meet these men that were now they're getting a little bit higher status and they're military men and other people in uniforms. And so she, you know, she quickly kind of on her own elevated herself.
Mm-hmm.
So she was doing that and she was getting a little bit older. And then she decided that she's like, the one way to really get attention is to be on the stage. And so she was going around Paris and she was going to all the different theaters and she was trying to get a job there performing on stage, but she really didn't have like any talent as far as being on the stage. She didn't really sing. She didn't dance. She didn't really act. But she went into one, which was a Bouffe Parisien, which I think it was like last spring. I think I stayed in an apartment that was right across from that. That was kind of exciting. But she went there. She met Jacques Offenbach, and he instantly, you know, she was very beautiful. She's just very stunning. And so he met her and thought, well, I'll give her a job. I'll have her do something. So she was put into the cast in 1866. And before the show started, they had asked, you know, what her name was. And everybody at the time pretty much just had a one name. So, you know, they just, you know, like Cher. Again, let's bring in Cher.
And I'm talking about Cher.
She, you know, so at the time she thought, well, she was going to change her name. It was originally Emily Louis. And so she changed it to Valtesse, which sounded a lot like Votre Altesse, which means Your Highness.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I'm totally going to do that. Valtesse Hemingway.
Love it.
So but they screwed up in the paper and they spelled it wrong. So her big debut of being in this show. And then they put it in the paper and they spelled it wrong. And, you know, of course, I'm sure she went running to, you know, buy the paper. And then you see your name was wrong. It was just crushing. But she had this red hair and she had this very big presence on the stage. but she was very shy and very quiet. So she didn't really command a presence in her abilities at all, but people noticed her because she had this stunning red, beautiful hair. And it had like, basically had like, you know, highlights of gold in it, in her hair.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The paintings of her, she looks, her hair looks beautiful.
Yeah. So the light, you know, the lights at the time, or, you know, I'm sure just was just beautiful. But Offenbach saw that she was a big presence, and she, the crowd actually really, really came to love her, even though she really didn't do anything and she didn't have a lot of talent. Yeah, she was pretty, and they really, they liked her. And so did Offenbach. And so he is the one, Jacques Offenbach is the one that wrote the famous Can-Can song. So the dun 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 dun.
I was like looking for it in my brain. I'm like, oh, there it is. Yeah.
He actually did that song, and it was first performed there. And so at the time, she was 21 years old. He was 50. Wow. And the two began to have an affair. Mm. And so he was quite the celebrity in Paris. You could go, I'll put pictures on my website, but there's pictures of him with like this great big, like what looks like this great big mink coat. And like, wow. He was quite the, you know, he's quite famous and quite the dandy around town. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he, of course, why not have this beautiful redhead on your arm, even though he had a wife?
Oh, whoops. Not yep. like it mattered back then.
No, it didn't. But it doesn't go so well. So the two of them decide to go away, and they go down to Italy. And the two of them, you know, going to have this nice little romantic trip. And she loved this because now all of a sudden, you know, he's giving her all this money and he's showering her with, you know, clothing and jewels and everything. And of course, she's just absolutely loves it from, you know, especially from her upbringing. Yeah. And it was in a secret around town because she was very visible, and as was he. And Madame Offenbach, even though she knew that her husband wasn't the most faithful person, this was different because it was really like really kind of shoved into her face.
Yeah, they weren't hiding it at all.
They weren't hiding it at all. So they decided to go down to have this little lover's tryst in Italy. Well, Madame Offenbach also found out about this and decided to go down there.
Oh, no.
And she arrived at the hotel and found him. And apparently it was quite the scene. The police ended up coming at some point. It's actually everything I've read saying there's no actual written description of what happened that day, but it was not good. It was very bad, and it involved her a lot of screaming. And Valtes decided, you know, I don't want to be a part of this. I want more with my life. And so she left.
So it sounded like she was going to be murdered if she didn't leave as well.
Yeah, I think Madame was going to, yeah, probably want to kill her. But yeah, I think it killed her husband too.
Yeah, I think it would have been a murder-suicide or something.
Exactly. So she came back to Paris, but he had done, what he had done when she was with him is he opened the door for her to all of this different, you know, this upper level of society in Paris. And so she had, you know, all of a sudden now, she had already met all these people. And so she thought at the same time, well, I'll just use this to my advantage. And, you know, what was the other thing that I knew how to do? And so she kind of decided to become a courtesan. Yeah. So, I mean, she's just like, well, now I have, you know, now she has all these wonderful clothes and these jewels and everything. And everybody knows who she is. So she might as well use it to her advantage.
Smart woman.
Very smart woman. But she, when she was at, when she was still at on the stage, she also met another man whose name was Richard Fossey. And he was he came from a very, very wealthy family. And he was absolutely in love with her. And the two of them actually had two children, two daughters.
Oh, wow. When did they get married?
They did not get married. She ended up, when she got pregnant the first time, she left Paris to go hide. And she kept a secret from everybody. Nobody had any idea that she had a child. Oh, and she got pregnant again with him too. And she had another little girl. And so she had, you know, left Paris to go and have these children and go hide. And then she came back, you know, all of, you know, rising from the ashes, just stunning and beautiful. And Fossey really wanted to marry her, but his family said, if you do, we will completely cut you off. And you will get nothing.
Oh, it's so sad.
Yeah. So he was shipped down to Algeria, and he told her, he was like, just wait, you know, we'll wait for each other. You know, don't, you know, see anybody else. I love you. I'll be back. Well, then a few months later, he sent her another letter and said, I met somebody, not coming back.
Whoops.
Which I think has been, we've had this story a few times.
Yeah, wow, the romance. And it's over.
I know. So that's the undying love. Well, sorry, not come back. So she, when she had both of her children, she had sent them to a wet nurse that had them until they were weaned. And then after that, she decided to take them to her mother, who, you know, we've already basically confirmed that her mother wasn't this wonderful person. But so Valtes took her two young babies and took them to her mother, and her mother took care of them. They were, they weren't in very good health to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so now mom's taking after him, looking after them.
That's not good news for the babies.
Yeah. So she had this, she was back in Paris. Nobody knew that she had any of these, had these two children. And she was back, and she was at, back at Offenbach's opera house, and she'd be back there performing and stuff. And then, but at the same time, it was 1870, the siege of Paris was coming in. And so at the same time, like she, you know, everything was kind of getting crazy, but with the siege of Paris came all these military men.
Hello. Love a man in uniform.
Yeah. So she ended up having another relationship with a man named Albert Milo, who was a playwright and a journalist. And he basically gave her anything and everything she wanted. He gave her an immense amount of money. She basically took care of and found a place for her in the south of France so she could get out of Paris. He paid for literally every single thing.
Wow. What happened to her kids?
They're still at her mom's. Still with her mom. They'll come back later. Don't worry. But nobody, literally nobody knew she even had children.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I mean, I guess back then, if with some of those dresses, you could kind of, you know, cover things up.
Because you wouldn't want to break yourself as a prostitute, as a courtesan. I mean, that would ruin your whole
Yeah, it's probably bad for business. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, like what did they do? I mean, there wasn't, you know, did they have a lot of birth control back then? Did they have, you know, like,
I think they had like pig skin, right?
Yeah. But she went back to the south of France, and she came back to Paris in time, and she witnessed the burning of the Tuileries, which is just, must have been a frightful, sad thing to see.
Yeah.
But then she ended up finding another lover, and he was a banker to Russia, Monsieur Gunzburg. And he was a banker to the Russian court, and he gave her 15,000 francs a month.
What?
Yeah. And so basically, you know, you had this, you know, you could put her on retainer.
<That's> amazing.
And she ended up finding this, apartment and a home on Rue Blanche as she was taking care of. And while most of the people in Paris were, you know, eating the elephants from the Jardin des Plantes and, you know, looking for any kind of food they can, she was doing a lot better than most people.
Just sounds like it. Also, I'm trying to imagine what these conversations were like when they were deciding how much to pay her. Like, you know, how much for putting you on a retainer? Like, Jesus.
Yeah. It's like for $5,000, you get this, but for $15,000, you get this.
Yeah, like, I would sleep with five other men for $10,000. Right.
I know. She was quite the businesswoman. But then after the Russian court banker came along, the Prince de Sagan came, and he was a very rich gentleman of Polish aristocracy, fell head over heels for her.
Gosh, and she's a heartbreaker.
I know. He was completely in love with her. In 1875, he paid to have a huge home built, and it was at 98 Boulevard de Malesherbes, is that right? Malesherbes. Mm-hmm. And in the 17th, and she basically, he gave her all the money. He paid for every single thing. She had it designed. She used architect Jules Ferrier. He designed the new building. She had painters, composers come to design like her music room and everything in it. She had a pink marble staircase done by Charles Garnier. Because it was right after he did the opera house, and he was quite the talk of Paris. And if anybody was going to do a staircase for her, it had to be Charles Garnier.
This is amazing.
Yeah, she had stained glass windows done by Durie, and even one of them included in the stained glass window a scene of Napoleon III visiting her bed.
This is insane.
I know. So sad that nothing remains. The property later was destroyed, which would have been stunning to see. But it's filled with like Louis XIV furniture, paintings by Courbet, Ingres, and other painters that ended up also being her lovers. But she had this huge place, and it was like the talk of Paris, of this apartment, everybody, this house, and everybody wanted to come in and see it. So at the same time, she also rented a house outside of Paris in the town of Ville d'Avray, which is the same one that Corot would always paint and tell her about.
Good memory.
So she would go out there and see, you know, she heard so much about this as she went and she found a house out there that she rented. And it had been rumored to have originally been built by Napoleon III for his trysts when he was near Saint-Cloud. And she was a very loyal Bonapartist. Like, she loved Napoleon Bonaparte. She loved Napoleon III. She held every year out at her property on August 15th, which is the birthday of Napoleon. She would have these humongous parties with fireworks and everything, all in like recognition of Napoleon.
I want to be friends with her.
I know.
Wow.
And like everybody, it was like the place to be. Like everybody in Paris wanted to be able to be on this invite.
So cool.
So, and at the time, you know, I mentioned earlier that she had the gold strands in her hair. So one of her nicknames was the Rayon d'Or, which is the ray of gold, which is because it had a little bit of that. She loved it because it had a little bit of the Sun King and the Golden Empire of Napoleon. So it was all like everything kind of, you know, went back to Napoleon. And she just, you know, this is how she invented herself and created this picture of who she was. It's just kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Coming from her background, she definitely broke out of the mold.
Yeah. So, you know, you asked about her daughters. Her daughters were raised by her mother. Her youngest daughter died at just 3 years old.
Oh, no surprise there.
Yeah, she was in pretty bad health the whole time. But still, nobody knew. Nobody knew, had any idea that she had any children. And so at that time, she was like literally the most talked about woman in Paris. Everybody was talking about her. Everybody knew what her profession was, but everybody was fascinated by her. Mm-hmm. So she decided to write a book, and she called the book Ego. And it was a name she used also in her home. Like, she would actually have it like created in the stained glass and on like the staircase, you know, with the bas-relief, she'd have it say Ego.
Wow.
Yeah. So she was pretty master of her own marketing.
Yeah, yeah, sure. It's kind of surprising because she was like shy in the beginning, and now. She doesn't sound very shy to me.
Maybe it had added some mystery.
Yes.
Yeah.
Being quiet.
So at the same time, when everybody's talking to about her, you know, everybody in Paris. So Emile Zola was writing a book about a courtesan, and many of his friends told him he needed to go and visit Bethes and talk to her because she was like the courtesan of the time. There was also like so many other courtesans in Paris at the time. So, you know, it wasn't like she was the only one. But she was definitely the one everybody was talking about the most.
Yeah, most interesting.
So an introduction was made, and he went to her house for dinner, thinking he was going to be the only one there to go to the house and talk to her. And she walks in, and there's all of these people there. And he's like, oh, well, you know, where is she? And, you know, she was just like, oh, no, you know, we're having dinner and we're doing this. And he walked in, and he wrote in this book that he wrote, Nana, later, and a lot of it is based on her, that when you walked in the house, there was this constant scent of violets. And violets were like her favorite flower and kind of her signature thing. But it was like the just violets, the smell of them were just like floating through the air in every room you went to.
That's so wild. I must have been those perfume lanterns, man.
I know, it must have been. I mean, that just like a flaming urn of perfume on your bed just kind of scares me though.
A fire hazard to me.
Yeah. So he, you know, comes in and he writes his book in October 1879. It's released, Nana, and it becomes a huge bestseller. It sold 55,000 copies in the first day alone.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which would be amazing now. I mean, that would be huge now. So she, you know, all of these different artists. So another artist, Gervaux, was another painter, and he ended up painting this amazing painting called Rolla. And I'll post a picture of it on my website. And it's this, they had it at the Musée d'Orsay for an exhibit a year or two ago. And it shows this woman basically kind of like after, you know, you could tell it's like it's an after their tryst moment. She's laying naked on the bed, almost falling off the bed. And he's standing at the window looking out on the street. In the background.
I love that painting. I have that on my refrigerator. It's a postcard on my refrigerator.
It's such a beautiful painting. But in the background of what he's looking at on the street is Valtesse's home.
Oh.
But the woman in there is not her. But it says they ended up having this love affair that went on for quite a long time. And he painted her. And he painted her many times, including a huge painting in the Marie of the 19th arrondissement. And he was asked to paint something that was going to be for their salle de mariage. And in that room, he painted this, and it's still there today, this huge image. And he used his lover, who is a courtesan, as the bride. And instead of taking it as, you know, the when you're married at the Marie, it's very civil, as you know, you've shot those pictures many times. Mm-hmm. And he had changed it and changed like the desk where the officiant standing, he turned it into an altar, and he added stained glass windows. So he kind of turned it into a church.
Yeah.
And he has Valtesse in there. And then she's turned and looking at the viewer.
Oh, interesting.
So people were like outraged, but they still hung it up, and it's still there today.
I can't believe they still hung it up. That's like so not what a Maori wedding is. Maori wedding is the mayor in the mayor's office.
Yeah. Yeah. And this one is just like, he basically turned it into a church, but people were pretty offended by. But another artist, Manet, also came to see her, and he, you know, Manet never liked to, you know, stay on the straight and narrow. And he met her and also was fascinated by her and painted her a few times. There's a painting of her in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And I just was reading this article recently written in 1950 about a journalist that was with Hemingway for a day, and they ended up going to this museum, and it said in there, and I just about like jumped out of my seat. I was so excited that it, all of a sudden he was like, oh, and Hemingway walked up, and here's this painting of Valtesse de la Beignet by Manet. And I was like, oh my gosh. But he was saying how, what a lovely painting it was, and that Manet could show the bloom people have when they're still innocent and before they've been disillusioned. Ooh. Was how Hemingway described it. But it's just, you know, all the paintings of her, she was a very beautiful woman. So there's not a whole lot of them. There's a few of them around, like there's some in the Orsay of her, but they are pretty interesting to check out.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely one in the Orsay, because we were talking about that before we started recording.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful painting. Go to the top floor, people.
Top floor. Always go straight to the top floor as soon as you walk in. But in 1881, her daughter, her one remaining daughter, was older. And she started getting worried about her safety because her mother, Valtesse's mother, her daughter's grandmother, was grooming her to become a prostitute.
Oh, perfect.
So Valtesse thought, well, I need to get her out of here. So she took her to court. It basically, like, it completely rocked Paris because nobody thought she even had children. And now she has this child that's like a teenager.
Wait, so she had to fight to get her daughter back?
Yeah. So she took her mother to court. And said, you know, she wanted to get custody of her, and it was this huge thing in Paris. Like it was the O.J. Simpson of the time.
Well, I'm surprised she had to fight her mom, because like, just go pick your kid up and leave, you know, whatever.
Yeah, her mom wasn't a great, really lovely person. So I think that's definitely why. But everybody was like literally captivated by it. People were filling in the courtroom every single day. They ended up coming to an agreement that her daughter was basically taken away from her grandmother, and she was put into a boarding school. And at the boarding school, she was able to still visit her grandmother and visit her mother. But people were just like completely shocked because they didn't even know she had a child.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so her mom was really ticked off because, you know, her mom's getting older, and this is how she's going to be making some money, is whoring out her granddaughter.
I'm means she just ruined her retirement.
That was her retirement plan.
Oh, God.
There's no 401k for the prostitutes. So she ended up later, this woman named Camille was Valtes's, like, one of her closest friends, but she also was, like, her maid and took care of her at her home. Well, one day her mother saw her on the street and attacked her.
What?
Like physically attacked her.
And, she's just a maid.
Yeah. And Valtes was just like, when Valtes finally found out about it, she was livid and she went to court again. Valtes's sisters also were in the same line of work and were incredibly jealous of her, of course, because here, you know, they also are, you know, prostitutes, but here they look at her sister and her sister has like multiple homes and like famous people in Paris at the time.
Wow.
Yeah. So she ended up actually losing the case with her mother about Camille. And then right after that, Valtes was just like, I've kind of had this. And she decided in 1902, she decided to sell her home in Paris and the one in Ville d'Avry and sell almost all of the contents.
Where'd she go?
Well, she sold everything. And it became this huge thing in Paris and everybody, because it was a way for everybody to be able to go into her home and see her home up close and personal. So on June 2nd, the very first day of a 4-day auction, they ended up raising £8 million. That's more than $10.5 million today, the first day.
That's insane.
Yeah. So there was so much to sell there that it went for 4 days. But she did not sell her bed that we talked about at the beginning. And the bed was designed by Edward Leve, and she wanted this huge bed that was fit for a queen. And she wanted this Renaissance. It was Renaissance style. And it kind of has it, when you see it, and I'll put pictures up, it kind of has a footboard on it that's almost kind of like a gate. So it was reminiscent of the Renaissance and like the bed when you go to Versailles and you see like the bed that the king would sleep in and stuff. And you've seen all the movies and things and how like when the king wakes up, there's 30 people in the room and they're just watching him. That's what she wanted. She wanted this like bed that would be the showpiece that people were, you know, she would greet her guests.
Oh gosh, sounds pretty extra to me.
Yeah, and it was gilt bronze and beechwood, and the back of it stands over 13 feet high and has a huge canopy. It's topped with the golden perfume burners. It's got carved golden animals and cherubs surrounding her initial V, and it had this beautiful blue velvet that hung down, and it was her signature color. Today, it's now green. It's kind of a light green. And I actually messaged the director of the museum and asked him, when did that change? But I never heard anything back.
Yeah.
So at some point, obviously, I mean, they, you know, 200, 150 years or so, I'm sure they had to replace it. But when you go to the museum, it's really interesting because they have the bed made, but then they have like the covers down. So it looks like somebody's about ready to get into it.
I like that. Well, but I can't believe she just like packed everything up and left. She was like, I'm tired of all this family drama.
Yeah. She was just like, I don't want to be here. So at the time the bed cost what would be $650,000 today.
What?
Yeah. So with all of the money that she made from her sales, her big, huge sales, she bought a different home in Ville d'Avry, and it was high up on the hill. It was called La Chapelle du Roi. And it was built in a Louis de Philippe Gothic style, but she had part of it demolished and rebuilt. And she basically wanted to redesign this whole thing on her own. So she had on the property, there was a studio made for the painter Detuil, who was her lover, who also painted her.
Lover.
Her lover. And I just like saying lover.
I love it.
So she had this place built for him. He, in this home, it was filled with paintings, and it was filled with paintings of her ancestors. Well, the fact was that only one of them was actually a real person. she had him paint these, all these different people. Like some of them were like military uniforms and all this stuff. She had whole stories created about who they were and which wars they fought in and everything, but they were all completely made up.
She rewrote history.
Yeah, except for one of them, the Grace de la Beignet was the only one that was actually a real life relative, but everybody else was made up.
Sounds like she had a vivid imagination.
Yeah, I mean, good for her. So yeah. I mean, people do that now. It's called Instagram.
Thing.
Yeah. So, but her in her later years, as she got older, you know, she was slowing down from the business a little bit, but she decided to take in young girls and give them lessons of how to be a courtesan.
I would love to sit in those classrooms. Like, what a lesson.
Yeah, but she also got really, like, she had this one lover that actually would go to what is now Vietnam. And he would send her letters and trinkets from there. She ended up getting involved in everything that was going on there and how horrible it was. And she, Leon Gambetta, who was high up an official, he was her neighbor out in Ville d'Evry. And so they ended up becoming friends, and she would send him letters about, you know, what the atrocities that were going on and what is now Vietnam. And when he suddenly passed away, all of it came to light and it was in the paper, and everybody is like, what? Now she's involved in politics?
That's so crazy.
Yeah. And it became kind of a huge scandal, but she also would write plays, and our friend that we've talked about before, Sarah Bernhardt, was going to play the lead role in one of her plays, but then it ended up never getting made.
Mm. It's interesting because I'm curious, like, what made her a better courtesan? Because, you know, obviously she's been doing something different to get all these men to fall in love with her and get all this money. And she had, what, like six sisters or one of six. And why didn't they get all this? You know, like, what was she doing differently?
Well, I mean, she seems like she definitely, with her interest in politics and everything else, I mean, it's kind of like Ninon, who was, you know, very smart and very witty and very up on, you know, the current situation and what was going on, that maybe that was kind of the difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, like Ninon said, that she kind of seduced him with her mind more than anything.
Yeah, she could actually have real conversations with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So in 1909, she started to have some vascular issues, and she had surgery in that November, and she came through it. But she felt like afterwards that she just kind of needed to get her life in order. She went and found her own grave in Ville d'Evry and had a very expensive coffin made, like incredibly expensive. And she even made note cards announcing her death with the date left blank.
What the?
Yeah. So she already had these things all created. So in July 1910, she was in terrible pain, and the doctors told her that she probably wasn't going to have that much longer to go. And it was July 29th. And so she asked for her note cards.
Wow.
She hand wrote the date of her death on them.
But what was the date?
And had them all addressed and said, you know, these need to go to my friends. And at 10:45 p.m. on July 29th, 1910, she died.
Wow.
She was only 48 years old.
Oh, she wasn't old at all.
Yeah. So the next day, the card started arriving in Paris. And of course, this is, you know, the early 1900s. So it's not, you know, there's no Twitter. So it's not like it's spreading everywhere. So these note cards started to arrive to people. And some of her friends were, of course, very upset. And then some of them were kind of thought, this is a trick. This is a secret coded message. No, she didn't actually die, because she was so theatrical about things.
Yeah.
So she did actually die. And on July 31st, carried by four white horses, her coffin was topped only with one small bouquet of violets.
Oh my goodness.
And when people saw this coffin go by, they were like gasping, because I mean, it must have cost what would be now hundreds of thousands of dollars. I guess it was incredibly lavish, just crazy. But so she was interred, and none of her family were allowed to come. But she was interred, and she even had this huge marble structure made. I'll post a picture. It's actually not there anymore at the grave. It's like, I don't know if it's just it's stolen or disappeared, or they just put it someplace else, but it's no longer there. But it was this huge marble structure, kind of like a tripod, and it was holding a globe, and on top of it was a huge eagle, of course, you know, for her love of the Bonaparte, and it had an urn that was supposed to be lit and always lit there.
Oh, I wish, wonder what happened to it.
Yeah, it's like disappeared now. But of course, being Valtesse, she kept it everything a mystery. And when she died, there was two other names written on it, L.M. Aurillac and E. Una. And everybody, nobody knows. There's nothing. It just, it's their names. There's no other information. And nobody knows who it is. It's still a mystery today who these two men are that are buried with her. One of them wasn't even dead yet when she was buried.
What? She was, wait, so she had a funeral and then she had two other dudes buried with her?
Yeah. I guess that's the way she's wanted to go. So Aurillac is thought to be this military man that she had this huge affair with. And she had very specific rules. Like she didn't show affection outside of, you know, her home. Like, you know, she was quite the regal woman. She didn't want to do that. But she had this, she was on the way out to her home and she was on this train with this military man. And that just the passion just was so crazy. They had to do something about it. And apparently, what would you say at a train? Is there a Mile High Club for a train? Because that's what happened.
Wow.
And it was publicly and people saw it. So some people think that Aurillac might have been him. Una hadn't even died yet. He was later buried with her. There's just all these, but still to this day, like I was researching it for hours trying to see if anybody's figured out who these people are, and they don't, then nobody knows.
That's so interesting. But what about her estate and what about her daughter? Who got all her stuff?
Well, her estate was left to her daughter and they had a huge art auction. She left very specific instructions on where things were supposed to go. She donated a lot of her art to the Musée de Luxembourg at the time, which is now, you know, now a lot of that's in the Louvre, the Cluny Museum, and also Versailles. Mm-hmm. And so she had all these things. She had a lot of her paintings of her quote unquote family were given to the Musée de Caen, which was basically destroyed in World War II.
Oh, no.
So all those things are left. But the bed, as we had said earlier, got donated to the Musée des Arts Décoratifs.
Wow. She's a fascinating woman. And I love how, once again, she broke that glass ceiling of courtesan. I mean, she killed it.
She did. I think we'll have to add this book to the book club.
Definitely. I want to read all about her.
Yeah. It's really a fascinating story.
Very fascinating. Well, we're all going to be going into the dark net to read more about it. And definitely tune in next week, guys, for another fascinating woman in French history. Thanks, Claudia.
I'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to Paris History Avec A Hemingway. If you want to find out some more, you could always find me on my Instagram page, Claudine Bleu Blanc Rouge, and that's B-L-E-U, as in the French way to spell it. And each day I post a daily history lesson about a person or a place or something in Paris, or it's lots of fun facts. And then also at claudinehemingway.com, where you could also sign up for my newsletter there.